week's edition of Debriefing the Law. I am Joel Oster.
I'm Chris Marone.
And Chris, this is going to be another exciting week of a podcasting because a lot has been going on in the world of legal news. We have a Donald Trump is in the news. Willis, who is she boinking and when? We have to know the answer to that. There's been some trades in the NFL market. Will the Chiefs three-peat? And there has been a sentencing of the child abuse cases over there in Utah. And so we have the Frankie.
Oh, yeah, Ruby. Ruby Frankie.
There's a lot to talk about. Hey, but first, this podcast is brought to you by Comedian of Law. Comedian of Law does the CLEs that educate and entertain. And Chris, we also are doing a feature CLE of the month at Comedian of Law. Ooh. And this month's feature CLE is going to be on the trial of Jesus. It is a fascinating tale. Chris, I don't have to tell you, this is Easter week, which means Cadbury egg time at the grocery store. Make sure you get your protein by ordering your Cadbury egg or your Reese's peanut butter egg. I don't know what is your jam, but
Reese's.
Now is the time to do that. And so it's Easter. Why not talk about one of the most significant, important trials of the millennia, the trial of Jesus. But first, we got some other stories to touch on before we get there. So let's just go to our headline. Oh, first of all, Ben Shapiro, I know your bud.
Oh, yeah.
He is a podcaster.
Super buddy.
When you listen to Ben Shapiro on his podcast, you have to say, did I accidentally hit my 2X button? Am I listening to this in the double time? No, that's just how he talks. Very much a fast talker. He was in the news this last week, was in a lot of trouble because he suggested that retirement was a bad idea. In fact, the USA Today wrote about it saying conservative pundit. By the way, whenever you hear the word pundit, you know it's going to be a negative article. Conservative pundit says retirement is a stupid idea. And he said, I agree. Let us work until we die. And Rex Hupke for the USA Today wrote, the whole concept of retiring so you can actually enjoy part of your life is lazy liberal nonsense, no different than catering to the weak work entitlements like lunch breaks or sick days. Chris, when I heard this on Ben Shapiro's podcast that retirement was a bad idea, I got to tell you, Chris, I was mad. Do you know why I was mad?
Well, you're in Florida now, Joel. You're in the retirement land. Like, you are, you're not pushing retirement age. I'll give you that. But you are definitely living the retirement life.
No. See, Chris, I wasn't mad at the idea. I was ticked that he stole my idea. I have been saying this for years. Retirement is anti-biblical. It's not there. I challenge you. Find a part of the Bible that says, you know, now it's time to enjoy our golden years and not work. In fact, I told my dad, I hate to say this, but I told my dad, he was working. So he kind of retired. But then he went to work at the local grocery store, Price Chopper there in Shawnee, Kansas. He was in the best health of his life because he was that's hard work working at a grocery store. That's not retirement. And I told Dad, I said, Dad, don't retire. The only thing left on your calendar after you retire is you die. He then retired, and I kid you not, 2 years later, he died of cancer. And you see that a lot. You see people, once they retire, their systems is shut down, and the next thing on their to-do list is to die. Chris, I'm very much an anti-retirement guy.
That's so, the idea of retirement isn't the idea of stopping work. My mom retired about 10 years ago. She volunteers for the library. She volunteers at the homeless shelter. She volunteers at the soup kitchen. She's in a financial position to be able to now volunteer all of her time to do more philanthropic things.
I agree 100%. She is
that's
right
what
on.
We mean by retirement. I want to be financially secure enough to retire to where I don't have to work for money.
So in other words, you have
and
to have a purpose.
That's not what Shapiro was saying. Shapiro was saying we need to keep our workforce, so we need to keep people working in meaningless jobs.
That's not
so that way we could support. The guy is such a corporate elitist hack that all he wants to do is to ensure that people are in debt until they die.
Chris,
that's what he's going for. That's the whole Ben Shapiro thing, is that the system of capitalism requires that we have a lower class working force to support jackwagons like him into thinking that he actually has a career by sitting there and talking like this every single time and making sure that we get it. Ben Shapiro, sit down and shut up, you entire prick.
The reason why I am laughing is I haven't gotten past this idea of you listening to Ben Shapiro. But that aside, Ben Shapiro was saying exactly what you were saying. You and Ben Shapiro are one and the same. I hate to break it to you.
Bro,
he was saying,
those are fighting words in the Marone household.
He was saying, look, you got to have purpose. And when you retire and you just kick back and say, I'm going to now enjoy my retirement years and do nothing, that is a problem.
That could be your purpose.
You have to have a purpose. No, that's what I'm saying. It should not be your purpose. Because I know this is just my theory, and I have slept at Holiday Inn Expresses, but take it for what it's worth, that your body shuts down. You see it. Whenever you hear like some coach steps down and retires, like Joe Paterno, he retired. Next thing you know, he's dead 90 days later.
Bro, do not Joe retire. Paterno may not be the best guy to be comparing on retirement discussions. Right.
Paul Bear Bryant steps down and retires.
There you go. Let's
boom,
go.
He's dead a few months later. No.
Right. But
you got to have a
purpose. It's not because he retired. My grandfather was a Teamster and delivered beer around San Francisco his entire life. He retired at 65 and he sat in his recliner and smoked Cuban cigars and drank cognac until he was 91.
All right.
He did nothing.
So there are exceptions to the rule. And again, I am not a doctor. Right. I am just saying, for what it's worth, if you want to argue about this point, that's the reason why I brought it up. But
always.
I think your system is smart. And when you have a purpose to your life, your system realizes that and it keeps things going. If once you mentally check out, I think also your immune system checks out. And again, I'm not a doctor, but I talked to doctors about this and they said, well, Joel, you're not quite on, but still you are right on something that when people retire, they do tend to die soon thereafter. And is it because maybe you stop exercising and stop having something to do? I don't know, but there's something there. Or I am very much anti-retirement. Now, that's
maybe the capitalist system that has failed America works you until you're near death and you get a year afterwards and you die because your body's been abused by a system that wants you to pay for everything and not be able to collect wealth. Call me crazy.
And there's
call me insane.
And there's that as well. But I will say I have spent some time in Florida hanging out with the retirees, and Chris, it is
loving it.
It's great, man. Because you know what? I feel so young. I'm out there playing.
Oh my
tennis
gosh. I was just thinking that. You need to get a little like you're young and not tan for Florida. And I'm telling you, man, you're not sitting out there at Boca playing pickleball.
I'm dominating that pickleball court, man. Yeah.
Absolutely. You're picking up pickleball games left and right.
I could do
that. Sitting Sheamus down.
I'm playing tennis with these guys and I'm poaching at the net, which means after my partner serves, I'm going to just jump over the net and grab that volley and slam it right down their throats and go, take that, grandpa. And I hate to
suck
say
it, gramps.
Take that, grandma. There's a grandma who showed up last week. That's just not
look
right.
At you living the retirement life and then bagging on retirement.
That is not right. But no, my thought is, again, I plan on retiring, i.e. scaling back what I do, because I can do this on the road. I can do my podcast. Mm-hmm. I can do my classes anywhere. We can move to Nicaragua, and enjoy the beach life with a lot less taxes, hopefully. I have no idea. That's what other people are doing, so I'm just saying that's a thing to do.
Yep.
And enjoy the good life, because I can do this anywhere. And I plan on doing CLEs the day I die. I'm probably going to say, hey, hold on there, Grim Reaper. I got to finish this so these guys can get their hours, and then you can go ahead and take me wherever you want to take me.
I got to administer this quiz real quick. Hold on, God.
That's right.
Hold on. Okay, they got their hours. Let's go.
God, do the poll question. All right, hey, also in the legal news, Ruby is parenting YouTuber Ruby Frank and her business partner Jody Hildenbrandt. They both pled guilty. By the way, the article reading said they who pleaded guilty. Chris, I am not a grammar expert. Is it pleaded guilty or pled guilty? Do you know?
You pled. It's pled.
So
you
why
pled
is it?
Guilty.
They said they pleaded guilty. I don't know.
Because they don't. Because they're not the ace legal reporter from NPR. They're
there you go.
Jamook from the Utah County Times.
All right. To child abuse charges when one of Frankie's children escaped Hildenbrandt's house in August to beg a neighbor for help. Maybe you remember reading about that. We also reported that just a little bit. Well, they both pled guilty, and now they were sentenced to up to 30 years in jail. Now, Chris, you are a former defense lawyer. You've represented people in criminal cases. So shed some light on this. Their prison time will be determined by the Utah Board of Pardons and Parole. And it says each count is 1 to 15 years in the court set up to 30 years in jail. So what's happening here?
So essentially, the courts are saying we're capping it at 30 years. If you serve 30, you're done. You're eligible to start applying for parole 1 year after entering the facility. So you're going to have to do at least a year of time, and then you can start applying for parole. Now, looking at some of these cases, right, it's abuse case, it's child neglect case. In the Utah system that is overcrowded, as are most prison systems here in America, usually non-violent, non-fraud, non-defrauding, people hurting crime. Like, there's crimes against society, right? And there's crimes against people. Some of those criminals are able to apply for parole and usually get granted house arrest, or they get stepped down to a different facility, or outright parole, probate, things to that effect. What they're going to look at is type of crime, what they've been doing while they've been on the inside, how are they a threat to the public, what sort of restrictions would it require, or taxpayer dollars on those restrictions. So, like, let's say that Ruby gets paroled after a year, she may have to be on house arrest, talk to a parole agent. She wouldn't be allowed within 1,000 yards of her children or a school, or she wouldn't be allowed to, you know, she'd be barred from certain licensings or types of jobs that are available out there. Or the parole board, the Utah parole board, may look at her and be like, man, you abused kids for a lot of years. So we're going to need you to spend some time and show some remorse and show some, you know, repentance and things to that effect, some rehabilitation, all, you know, the three R's of being in prison, and then make a decision from there. But it means that they're eligible after a year.
Speaking
that they can apply for parole.
Speaking of the three R's at their sentencing, these are what the defendants told the court. I think they're already, apparently their attorney is just as smart as you. They're already trying to lay out the groundwork for at least one of those R's. Frankie thanked the public officials who rescued her children, called them angels for saving her children from herself. Mm-hmm. She said, my charges are just. They offer safety to my family, accountability to the public. And so I think they're already trying to say yes, what we did was wrong, and we now need to pay the price, because that might help them at the end get out just a bit earlier.
Absolutely. All right, because the parole board's not going to release somebody that's like, I did nothing wrong, I'm a good parent. They're going to be like, you tied your kids up with duct tape, and you denied them food. That's not being a good parent.
I don't want to make light of this, but if they're taking bent, next time we'll use stronger duct tape. That's not going to get you out early. No, they're going to add some years.
Right. So you have to be repentant, and you have to, you know, show some the fact that you want to be rehabilitated. Right. Go take everything's online now. Right. And so you could go get your associate's degree in child development to show like a new, like, you're trying to better yourself in a way that's going to be able to help children and rather than hurt children. And you're trying to learn and grow, and you've accepted what you did is wrong. And you know, those are the ways that the parole board's going to look at you. And, you know, you may only serve 2 years, 2.5 years, which back in the day would have caused huge public outrage. But because of our attention spans today, we're never going to talk about Ruby again after she goes to jail.
I do believe they have to allow some time for her to be in jail for this to leave the public's mind and attention.
Yeah.
Maybe 5 years or, it was some period of time. So it's kind of out of the news. So it could be done a little bit quieter, because right now they can't let her out tomorrow because there'd be a public outcry. All right.
Yep.
Well, again, at Comedian of Law, we do CLEs, and we try to stay current with them. And next month, our feature CLE, not this month. This month is going to be Easter. We're focusing on the trial of Jesus. But next month, we are going to deal with Trump's legal trials. And that is going to be a whopper of a CLE. I highly recommend, even if you're not a lawyer,
25 hours.
Take that CLE, because it is going to be jam-packed with a lot of good stuff. A lot of ethical issues with that trial. Well, let's touch on one of them here, because Trump is in the news this week. One of his many criminal trials is going on in Georgia. It's the one that I said I fear the most for Trump, or that Trump should fear the most, because that's outside of the federal system. He can't control that. He can't pardon himself. The next administration can't pardon him. In fact, even the governor of Georgia can't pardon him. So this is the scariest trial for him. Well, the judge there, the trial judge, dismissed some of the claims this last week. So if you just want to think about it, there's two different types of claims, and I know there's a hundred of them, but just for our purposes here, you have overt acts claims. In other words, Trump did overt acts to undo the election. Those charges were not touched, because with those charges, Trump knows what he did. Or he knows what they're alleging that he did, and so he can formulate a defense. But when it came to the solicitation claims, the trial judge says Trump does not necessarily know. He has not put on notice as to what he did, and here is why. So under the solicitation claims, you have to allege what was the underlying felony that you solicited someone else to join with you to violate. And here, all that the charging arguments said was that these various public officials were solicited to violate their oath of office. Well, right there, they didn't describe what the oath was, but the judge said that's not a problem because each one of these public officials only had one oath. So they went to that oath. And the only thing arguable about that oath that could have been relevant here was their oath to uphold their respective constitutions. And so basically Trump was soliciting public officials to commit constitutional violations. But Chris, that's it. That's all that was in those charging documents. Well, I'm a constitutional lawyer. You can violate the Constitution in numerous, thousands of different ways. And that was what the judge was saying. You got to kind of give Trump a heads up as to what the constitutional violation was so he can prepare a defense once he gets in court. So the court dismissed those solicitation claims because the prosecutor failed to identify what the constitutional violation was that he was soliciting people to violate. Any thoughts on this?
I mean, there's a great great discussion about void for vagueness, right? That if you you can't just charge Joel and Chris for some crime that happened somewhere along the line.
Right.
If we're going to deprive someone of life, liberty, or property, which are all Fourth Amendment protected, ideals, you have to be very clear on what your violation is. You can't just say Chris stole something.
Right.
You got to say Chris walked into a Louis Vuitton store in the Scottsdale Fashion Mall and proceeded to take a Louis Vuitton Jen Hula purse, stick it under his shirt, and walk out the door.
Right.
Like, you have to be specific to be able to say this is the crime that I'm charging Chris with. Now, opinions, right? Do I think Trump violated the Constitution? Absolutely. Do you think Trump violated the Constitution? Not so much. Great. We can have opinions. We're pundits. But when you're charging someone in a court of law, you need to be as specific as my example was. You can't just say you stole something and kind of give it, we'll figure it out as we go through the trial.
Right. Was it a free speech violation? Was it a Fourth Amendment violation? Was it a First? I mean, you don't know. And
Third Amendment violation? We don't know.
And you can see how the prosecutor would want to hide the ball, because that way when you're in front of the jury, the defense is kind of thinking, oh, I think they're going to attack my Fourth Amendment issues, and they come in and say, nope, we're going for the First Amendment issues. Like, well, I didn't prepare for that. Well, you should have prepared for the entire Constitution. That's not how it works.
It's not how it works at all, and even in the slightest, because the point is we want to avoid being in court. The point of a criminal proceeding, if I present a strong enough case, and I used to talk to people about this, because I'd have friends that would look at me and they'd be like, how do you defend those criminals? And it was, look, if the prosecution does their job and the police do their job, I'm pretty useless at court. Like, I have no room to talk. And that's why 90%+ of cases settle before they get to trial. If the prosecution locks down a solid case with solid facts and there's no wiggle room to argue, then hey, guess what? We did our jobs, and this person's guilty of a crime. Right. And probably let's plead and let's go.
And probably that's not even going to trial. You're settling. You're taking a plea. Whatever. You're moving on with your life.
You're walking away.
That situation. Right. All right. So what is next here in this situation? Because now these charges have been dropped, but some charges remain. How is this going to impact a trial? Because what I'm looking at here, Chris, this was a huge win for Trump. Not that he doesn't now face criminal charges, but will this insert a delay in the proceedings and push this past the election?
110%. Like, this is a stall tactic for all stall tactics. And there's, and look, Trump's lawyer is earning every penny that Trump's not paying him. Let's just be honest. Like, Trump's lawyer is using every single tool at their disposal to stall this trial as long as humanly possible. Because whether you like it or not, if you get convicted and you're sentenced to jail while you're running for president, whether that gets overturned on appeal or whether this is a political trial or whatever, when you're going through the motions, prison orange is not a good look when you're asking people to vote for you. And it's not. So we could talk about the silliness of the trial and whether or not the conviction is going to stand, because that's a completely separate issue. But the optics of Trump being in prison orange during the campaign season and allowing his opponent to just hit the button of, look, you're either picking a convicted, you know, felon who was convicted on conspiracy to overturn an election, or you're voting for the guy whose memory's a little weak right now.
Right.
Who do you want?
Because, you know, my take on it is the more that Trump stays in the courtroom and off the debate stage, the better his chances are of winning the next election.
Absolutely.
I think his supporters have forgotten how bad he looks during the debate.
Everything.
Yeah, Trump needs to just say, I want to debate, and then just pray to God that Biden says, I'm not going to debate you, because that is not going to help Trump out. But again, that's just my personal take. We'll have to see if I end up being right, or do I need to edit that part out of this podcast? All right. So, Chris, I think what's going to happen here is his lawyers are going to say, look, these charges need to go forward at the same time. And the judge, they like judicial economy, and these are all related to the exact same issue. Mm-hmm. It makes no sense to have a big old long trial now over these exact same issues and then have another trial a year later with the exact,
same witnesses.
And it just does not make sense. So I do think the judge would be very, if you take politics out of it, will, you know, continue this case so they all can be tried together. If indeed that's what the prosecution wants, or the prosecution might just drop those charges and say, no, we want to go through with this right now before the election. So we're going to drop those other charges and not refile them. That also is a possibility. So we'll have to
wait. It's the smarter of the two.
All right.
Well, it's the smarter of the two. And you have a statute of limitations on these.
Right.
So let's say you drop them. Right. You have a year to refile.
I think they even gave him 6 months and they say, look, the statute might have run, but we're going to give you another 6 months to correct your mess up.
Right. So that puts us in November. No, that puts us in September. So if we do 6 months from Monday, that puts us on September 11th.
We'll have to be refiled.
So, that'd be an awkward refiling date. September 11th refile.
That's true. They might jump that one. Do it a little bit quicker. All right, Chris, also as on this same issue is the issue of the DA and the lead prosecutor. And I'm sure you follow this in the news. There's been a lot of hearings over this, whether or not the DA has been boinking the lead prosecutor. And Chris, I know you have had problems with this, and I have had problems with this, wrapping my mind around, how is that a conflict in court? Now, I know that it's bad, it's unseemly, but just let's take the testimony aside, and we'll deal with that later. If she was boinking the lead prosecutor, how does that impact the charges against Trump? And so I'm having a hard time wrapping my mind around it. Any thoughts?
Well, again, the defense attorney earning every single penny that is being paid by Trump's donors. Like, it has nothing to do. If she was engaged in a sexual relationship with the defense attorney, yes, that would be huge issues. That would be giant conflicts of interest. app, or if she was engaged in a sexual relationship with the judge of the case, or I would even venture to say the court clerk, or even I would go down as to the bailiff.
Right.
People who have to appear to remain neutral at all times. I would say that would be a clear conflict of interest.
Right.
If you're diddling someone at your office, is that bad office politics?
Let's take a look at it a different way. Let's say husband and wife are in the same office and they're both prosecuting.
Which is out of the ordinary.
Right. They're on the
same. Because I work with my wife here at my office.
Okay. So they're on the same prosecution team. That's not right. A conflict of interest. If husband hires wife and we all, okay, well, the husband's hiring wife, yet they're both being paid. The issue then is, are they being paid the right amount, or are you like paying them five times the going rate? But if you're just paying them what you pay lawyers, how is that a conflict of interest that you're in the same family? So you're going to get some of the benefits from that payment. I'm having a hard time wrapping my mind around the actual conflict here. I mean, I know it's unseemly, but where is the conflict?
Well, I mean, we want to pass moral judgment on the sexual actions of people in Georgia. Great. There's a lot of moral judgment to be passed around in my own backyard, let alone borrowing it from the DA's office and Fannie and this prosecutor. It's a stall tactic. The point of it is a stall tactic to allow another angle for media to report on to show how somehow Donald Trump isn't getting a fair trial.
All right. Now, for the record, I do want to touch on two other issues, and then we got to get moving on to the main point of this podcast. But those two issues are, what is Trump's attorney's argument here that there is a conflict? Trump's attorney's argument is, look, you hired this prosecutor, you being Fannie Wells, hired this prosecutor to prosecute Trump. You're paying him over $600,000 and a lot of money to prosecute this. And now you have taken lavish trips with this person and he's expensing those trips, and you get the benefit of those trips. Now, she says, I paid him back every time via cash, no receipts. Okay, that's suspect a little bit, but you know, to her credit, she's saying, I did not go on those trips for free. I paid every amount back. I just have no receipts. I just paid in cash. All right, so that's her defense. The other thought is that, Chris, I worry about the idea. I know this might not be, the whole conflict is somewhat suspect, but there was a hearing on it. I'm troubled by the fact that the DA, I believe, perjured herself on the stand by lying about the affair. The evidence shows that they were texting each other thousands of times, and he even went over to her house after midnight and didn't leave her house until 5 a.m. the next morning. Chris, I've never gone over to a fellow lawyer's house at midnight and stayed until 5 a.m. That's just a little bit suspect. They took trips to Chattanooga where they said,
clearly the Paris of the South.
Yeah, if you've ever gone from Atlanta to Chattanooga, they said they went there for lunch. Chris, I'm calling BS on that. I dread driving through Chattanooga. The traffic in Chattanooga is nightmarish. You don't drive to Chattanooga for lunch. No one does that. If you're going to Chattanooga, if for some other reason, maybe no one would recognize you as you're boinking your buddy there. So I am worried. I think she perjured herself. And I believe so much so that, Chris, if you were married, And your spouse did all the things that Fannie and this person did, you'd be divorcing your spouse. Or you'd be having a serious conversation of why were you unfaithful. Don't say you weren't. I'm not going to buy it. That's a load of crap. And so why would she perjure herself on the stand on an issue that really is not that important as far as the actual conflicts?
I don't think she did. Is it suspect? Absolutely. So everything's suspect. I don't think she perjured herself. I don't think that the evidence is conclusive enough. And I don't want to sit here and defend and go, well, you know, my personal experiences, I've been over to lawyers' houses from midnight to 6 a.m. and we didn't have sex. I've gone to lunches at random places. I've driven to Vancouver from Sacramento to go eat at a Japanese food place that was amazing. Whatever. I didn't have sex with the person that I drove there with, but he was a very nice gentleman. We were very good friends. But did she commit perjury? Again, it's muddying the waters. If she did, right? Bring charges.
All right, well, I do
bring charges.
I do believe that is going to be the outcome of this issue. I'll put myself out there as being a predictor of things that never happen. I believe that this judge is going to say, look, even if this affair happened, it does not amount to a conflict of interest that would disqualify her from this case and cite the various reasons that we have given. And then he will leave it to other bodies to analyze whether or not there was a perjury that was committed or whether her license should be suspended because she lied to a judge. That will be left for another round of questioning to be brought. But as far as this case is concerned, the judge is probably going to say, even if this happened, it didn't amount to a conflict of interest that would disqualify the DA. Right. So that's my prediction. I could be wrong, but that is what I'm going to stick with.
Even if they disqualify the DA and say, you can't prosecute this case, she's not the one prosecuting it. Kick her out of the courtroom, call it a day.
Right. All right. So now let's get to one of the biggest trials in the history of the world. And so we're talking about the trial of Jesus. It's going to be part one of a two-part series.
Ooh.
Chris, I want this podcast to be more true crimes based because apparently true crimes are all the hit. Murder is big business, and I like big business. And so I'm not suggesting anyone go out there and commit a murder so we can cover it. That is not what I'm saying. Wink and a nod. No, seriously, don't do that.
Don't do that.
But
no.
If you're going to do it, yeah, let me know afterwards. I'm just saying that would be make for great.
Nope.
Okay, we're not going to do that.
Nope.
All right.
Nope. Don't let us know. Nope. We don't want. No. That is trouble we don't want to borrow.
But murder is big business. And
the
trial of Jesus is one of these true crimes that has affected all of millennia. And so let's set the stage here for what this trial was about. First of all, Chris, we're going to talk about the trial of Jesus, and this is during Easter time. Easter is going to be this next Sunday, I believe, is Palm Sunday. Chris, do you celebrate Palm Sunday in your church?
Not traditionally. We talk about Palm Sunday. Like, the next two Sundays are obviously going to be a very heavy focus on the resurrection of Jesus Christ. This Sunday, it's going to be a discussion about peace in Christ and
It used to be back in the last generation when things were done right, right? When I was a kid. Why do we always think that how the way things were when we were brought up is the way it should always be? But that aside,
absolutely not.
On Palm Sunday, all these little kids were handed these little tiny palms and they just waved them on a Sunday morning. You know, it's like, oh, this is Palm Sunday. Look at all the little kids out there with the little tiny palms. And then I moved to Florida and I had a palm tree. And I'm going, okay, I've never seen this palm branch on a Sunday morning. We're talking branches that are humongous with thorns all over them. Is that the palms that you were waving? I have no idea what the palm trees were like there in the Middle East, but not these little tiny cute ones that you wave on a Sunday morning. All right.
Shocking that the church misrepresented what a palm tree was when you were a kid.
All right, so we're just entering into this season where I don't know if celebrating is the right word, but at least the trial of Jesus was definitely a major part of the Easter story. But Chris, there is some difficulty in analyzing this story because this is going to involve the interposition of religious beliefs and religious understandings and historical beliefs and understandings. And so it's kind of hard to approach the trial of Jesus and say, am I approaching this from a historical sense of, because there actually was an historical Jesus who actually lived there in Galilee and Judea and who walked amongst people. You can look in the history books and you can learn about that. But we also understand a lot about the trial of Jesus from religious texts. And so let's just lay it out there with a disclaimer. because we are lawyers, we love to disclaim that it is going to be difficult. And sometimes we're going to be intermixing the two different, you know, belief systems, but that's just what it is. It's kind of hard to approach this topic without kind of intermingling your historical understandings with also your religious understandings. Chris, I'm just curious, in your churches that you have attended, did you guys ever discuss the historical Jesus? I'm talking like Tacitus. Tacitus was a Roman historian who wrote about Jesus. Flavius Josephus was a Jewish historian who also wrote about the historical Jesus. Neither one of these were Christians authors,
right?
But yet they wrote about this person named Jesus who existed in a Galilee.
Yeah, we've had pretty in-depth discussions about, one, what a historically accurate Jesus would have looked like.
Right.
What a historical Mary Magdalene would have looked like. We've delved into this as part of a discussion of a better understanding of the culture of Israel and Jerusalem and the conflicts that were going on. We've had great discussion about, you know, there's a historical context of the three wise men and how that would have played out, you know, how they would have journeyed over. We've had just in-depth, sometimes speculative things, you know, that's part of religion, is speculation. But we've really discussed specifically more and greater understanding to the historical context of the geopolitical nature of Bethlehem and Jerusalem at the time,
right,
to give us a better understanding of the miracles that Christ performed.
I mean, this happened during the, I don't want to say the height of the Roman Empire, but, you know, Julius Caesar was there. Also his followers right now, or his successor, whose name I'm not remembering right now. But yeah, this was, so we actually have, you know, some historians there at the Roman Empire writing about this time period as well. So we have a lot of historical documents to glean from. Also, we have the writings of in the Bible and some other writings that didn't make it to the Bible, like the Gospel of Peter. I know we don't ever study the Gospel of Peter in our church. I doubt you do there. If you have a writing that pretends to date back to that time period, and it's writing about things that they witnessed during that time period, that's historical evidence. You might say, well, it's not in my, you know, biblical canon. Okay, no, we're not saying it's your religious text,
scrolls, stuff like that,
but it's still your historical, that would be relevant historically as to a writing about a certain event. How do you even know that Homer existed, that Socrates existed, right? I mean, we didn't see their YouTube video. No, you read about people who wrote about those people during that certain time period, or you read about their writings, right? That's how you know someone existed. So the fact there is a Gospel of Peter that's in existence, yeah, you might question its authenticity, is still going to be relevant when you're talking about historical analysis. All right.
Absolutely.
So you have the four Gospels. Now, these would be considered religious texts, but also they were written by people during that time period. They can be analyzed historically for their historical worth. But then also you have the letters from Peter, who also wrote about this trial that was also a part of the biblical canon. So you have a lot of different writings that will describe this time period. I find that fascinating. Also, Chris, we have legal systems at play. Now, this happened.
Oh my gosh!
This whole
systems.
Right. This trial took place in Jerusalem, right?
Yep.
And you're going to have two different legal systems at play. You're going to have the Roman legal system, which we're going to talk about here in a bit, but also you're going to have a Jewish religious legal system at play. Think of it, though it's not quite the same, but think of it in terms of our current legal system here in America, where you have two different legal systems at play, depending upon where you live. Chris, you live in Arizona, so you would have Arizona state laws, and you would have a federal law on top of that. And so you would say, what law applies? Well, you probably would say, well, your federal law is going to be first and foremost, and then where it doesn't really cover, the state law is then going to jump up and then apply in certain situations. Now, I know it's a rough summary of the relationship between state and federal law, but still you get these two different legal systems. One is going to be supreme over the other.
Yep.
Same is true over there in during Jesus' time. You had the Roman law was the most important prevalent law. And so that's going to be your supreme law. But the Romans also allowed the Jewish people to have their own laws as well.
Yep.
As long as they did not conflict with the Roman law. So we don't know what the law was for the Jewish people at the time of this trial, but we do know what it was 200 years later. So we actually have it written. It's called the Mishnah Sanhedrin. This actually is going to be, they codified their law. So Chris, this is relevant to us because if they codified it 200 years later, that would be like in America, if we had a common law that we then codified 200 years later. And so the codification would be a summary of what the law kind of already was. I mean, you're not just recreating brand new law when you codify it. You're trying to write down what we have already been doing. You might change a couple of things here and there. So let's go over a couple of the different legal principles that we know the Jewish people codified in the Mishnah Sanhedrin in 200 AD. All right. First one, non-capital case. And by the way, Chris, I'm going to be fascinated in your response to what these laws, how are they different than today, and what you think of
them. All right.
Let's talk about the Mishnah Sanhedrin 4.1. This talks about how you have, in non-capital cases, you have to hold trial during the daytime, and the verdict may be reached during the night. But in capital cases, they hold the trial during the daytime, and the verdict must also be reached during the daytime. In non-capital cases, the verdict, whether of acquittal or of a conviction, may be reached the same day. But in capital cases, a verdict of acquittal may be reached on the same day, but a verdict of conviction not until the following day. Any thoughts on Mishnah Sanhedrin 4.1?
Man, we're setting a good stage. Setting the stage right for the trial of Jesus. But yeah, I mean, you could see that resonate in society today because we do trials during the 8 to 5 business hours.
Right.
I think a lot of people forget. Well, that's not true. A lot of people aren't just educated to where this 8 to 5 sun up to sundown work day came from. And the, you know, yeah, did Henry Ford come up with the quote unquote 40-hour work week to modernize whatever's going on because we're no longer, you know, slaves to the sun? But a lot of these ideological processes that we have are based in these very, very historical and common sense type things. You know, sun up to sundown, that was your work day in any sort of pre-industrial revolution times. And so, yeah, only in non-capital cases, like you want to go home that day. Well, we want to get this person either home or to jail for their crime. So let's get a verdict as soon as humanly possible. And in the capital cases, no, this is something that we really need to focus on. This could be their last meal at home or not.
So we're going to have an order someone to death, we're going to give them the death sentence. The thought is, okay, maybe we should sleep on it. Maybe we should not let our rash judgment control the outcome. Well, and man,
some of those trials, man, they're, you know, we have some pretty heavy-handed rules of decorum in our courtrooms now, right? We can't personally attack. We can't start screaming at people. We can't badger a witness. You know, we can't be hostile, all that stuff. Back in those days, boy, howdy, it was a slobber knocker. They're screaming at each other. Emotions are running high. You could have victims and all sorts of stuff testifying and screaming and calling names and all sorts of stuff.
This next
one. So it was good
to
step back.
This next rule is pretty interesting. The Mishnah 5.1-4, it actually lays out how you cross-examine witnesses. When I say lays out, like the questions you should ask. And so this is how you would prove the truth of a matter. You would ask the witness, in what week of years, in what year, in what month, on what day, in what hour, and in what place? That's how they would ask those questions. That's you're going to ask a witness, you would say, hey, now you need to give us the actual time that took place, so you need to ask those specific questions. And then they would say, do you recognize him? Did you warn him if a man committed adultery? They would ask the witness, what did he worship and how did he worship it? So kind of laid out the questions you would ask of someone who was put on charge of an offense. Is there any current counterpart to that? I can't think of any federal or state rule that says you need to ask these type of questions.
I mean, you have to lay foundation, right? So you have to build up. You can't just say, I saw Joel stab somebody. You have to be like, well, on the night in question, I was at the AM/PM gas station located at Main and Broadway in Mesa, Arizona. I saw a white Oldsmobile LeSabre pull up with license plate, comedian of law, bumper sticker, the whole nine yards. I saw a gentleman matching the description of the defendant get out of the vehicle and then proceed to beat up the heavier set gentleman in the Hawaiian shirt on said night, talking about how Clarence Thomas was the best Supreme Court justice of all time.
Right.
You have to build a foundation to get, but it's not the same cadence as in what like you can't just jump to, I saw Joel beat up Chris.
Right.
You got to get there.
But what I also like about they wanted two witnesses, right? Okay, we got one witness, but man, if we got the second witness that would come and verify what the first person said, that is solid. But there was some room in here for witnesses to misremember things. Here's one example under section 3 of Mishnah 5.1-4. It says that one witness said on the second of the month, and the other said on the third. Okay, well, it's a little bit of difference there. Their evidence remains valid since one may have known the month was intercalated and the other did not know the month was intercalated. But if one said on the third and the other said on the fifth, their evidence becomes invalid. So apparently, because of the
way
times work, you might get confused as to what day it took place. If there was a 2-day discrepancy, then you're going to throw out that whole matter. But if they're just one off, you're going to say that that's close enough and are going to allow that testimony.
What was the calendar back then? Because the calendar that we use now, the Gregorian calendar, right, was created by Gregorian Christian monks.
Right.
So full stop, right? So Tuesday, today is Wednesday, Thursday, March 14th, 2024. So it's Pi Day. Happy Pi Day, everybody. 3.14.
That's right.
But this calendar wasn't developed until mid 10th, 11th century by Gregorian Christian monks. So what calendaring system did the Jews use, and how accurate was it, and how educated were people on the calendar? Well, it was on the second. Well, technically, that was actually the third day of the month, because you see, the palm fronds had grown 11 inches out,
right,
and the sun at... So, I mean, you have to allow for an inaccurate system to adjust for inaccuracy.
And I don't actually have the right time of the day, but I do know that under the Jewish calendar, the day actually would start, I believe, in the evening, something to that effect. And so,
the Sabbath is the sixth day of the week, and not the the Sabbath is Saturday.
And it starts in the evening, not in the middle of the night. And so, there's a little bit of a difference as to what day you're actually talking about. So the law accounted for that. All right. Here's an interesting one. Mishnah 7.4, crimes meriting stoning. And so we're talking about the death sentence now. And so under Jewish law, they did have a provision for stoning, i.e. not crucifixion. How's that for a teaser for later on? But you could order stoning, the death sentence. And here is how, here are the crimes that would merit stoning under the Mishnah. It said, these are they that are to be stoned. He that has connection with his mother. By the way, Chris, I think you can interpret connection to be a sexual relationship.
So, yes, you can.
I don't know that for sure, but I'm pretty sure that's exactly what this means.
I'm 100% sure.
Yeah, he that has connection 100%. With his mother, his father's wife, his daughter-in-law, a male or a beast, and the woman that suffers connection with a beast, and the blasphemer. And so the first part, there were sexual crimes, that they, under the Jewish law, would merit stoning.
Tracking the sexual crimes.
Right.
Okay. Tracking there with the beast.
The blasphemer and the idolater. Okay.
Okay.
And he that offers any of his seed to Molech, and he that has a similar spirit and a soothsayer. I'm not sure I even know what that means. I kind of know what offers your seed to Molech. I think I know what that means. I think that's referring to the Seinfeld episode where there was a competition. I think that's what that is in reference to. And he that has a familiar spirit and a soothsayer. So you deal with soothsayers? Now you deserve to be stoned. And he that profanes the Sabbath. I think a current counterpart would be he that profanes the football, National Football League. You know, that's what we do on the Sabbath now. And he that curses his father or his mother. I'm all about that one. I mean, yeah, you don't diss your mom or your dad. Right. And he that has a connection with a girl that is betrothed. And he that beguiles others to commit idolatry. And he that leads a whole town astray. And the sorcerer and a stubborn and rebellious son. Apparently a stubborn and rebellious daughter is, what's that?
You have to lead a whole town astray.
I don't even know what that
means. What is a whole town?
I have no idea.
I live in the Phoenix metro area. There's roughly 5 million people here. So if I need to lead 5 million people astray?
I don't know.
I mean, there's a lot of Dodger fans here, so they're already on that path.
You referenced earlier about vagueness in our laws. I'm seeing some vagueness challenges to that law. I would bring a Section 1983 lawsuit against that statutory provision, and it is vague. We need some more specificity to that statute. All right.
Absolutely.
How do you do the stoning, you asked? Well, I didn't actually hear you ask that, but I'm sure that was in your mind.
How do you do the stoning, Joel?
There you go. Mishnah 6.1-4 is going to deal with how you do the stoning. When the sentence has been passed, they take him forth to stone him. The place of stoning was outside the court, as it is written, bring forth him that hath cursed without the camp. So take him outside the camp area, outside the court. One stands at the door of the court with a towel in his hand, and the other mounted on a horse far away from him, but where he's able to see him. I guess the thought there is that you're on a horse, so if he tries to run away, you can track him down. What's the towel for?
Get blood off yourself.
I guess. All right. Probably so.
Yeah.
All right. Clean
the blood off of yourself.
If one in court said, I have somewhat to argue in favor of his acquittal. Okay. Here's where the towel comes in. That man waves a towel and the horse runs and stops him. The stoner. So someone said, hey, you know what? I actually think he didn't do it. They're going to wave the towel and they're going to stop the stoning. Even if he himself said, I have somewhat to argue in favor of my acquittal, they must bring him back, be it four times or five, provided that there is any substance in his word. So four or five times, you can keep bringing this person back for another hearing, I guess. If they found him innocent, they set him free. Otherwise, he goes forth to be stoned. A herald goes out before him, announcing, such a one, the son of such a one, is going forth to be stoned for that he committed such or such an offense. Such a one and such a one are witnesses against him. If any man knoweth anything in favor of his acquittal, let him come plead it. So there, while you're going to the stoning, you're supposed to announce, hey, this guy, son of this guy, is going to be stoned based upon this witness and this witness. If any of you has anything relevant, now would be a good time to bring it forward. Any thoughts on whether that system is better than ours?
No. Any system that stones people based off of two witness accounts is not a good system.
Now you get a call from the governor at the last minute. There you can have anyone just jump up and say.
Eyewitness accounts are historically, obviously, we're going to see in this trial, historically inaccurate and based on your opinion. I could find two people right now that could say Donald Trump is a fraud. And booyah, let's get to stoning.
And, I get two and people he led that the whole Donald town
Trump
astray.
Engage. Oh, well, we're not even getting into Donald Trump's sexual sins. Stormy Daniels.
Yeah.
Right?
I don't want to go there.
So, right. So not a great system. Not
All right. So a couple other interesting things about system. When the person to be stoned was 4 cubits from the place of stoning, they stripped off his clothes. A man is kept covered in front and a woman both in front and behind. And so there actually is a little bit of controversy. Another Mishnah said a man is stoned naked, but a woman is not stoned naked. So there's a little bit of controversy about whether or not the person should be naked while they're being stoned. The place of stoning was twice the height of the man. I guess it kept this person from running away. And one of the witnesses knocked him down on his loins. If he turned over on his heart, the witness turned him over again on his loins. And that way, the straightaway, so it gives a little bit of the process on how the stoning took place.
Glad they used their time to explain how stoning should take place.
Kind of graphic there. All right, quickly here before we jump into some football analysis, what was the actual crime that Jesus committed? And so I think you have to understand in this era where you have Roman law was supreme, Jewish law was secondary, you had to keep the peace. That's what the Romans cared about. The Romans cared about money. And they cared about keeping the peace. And so now when Jesus walked in to the temple courts that week before, what we would celebrate as Easter. So,
the middle of that week,
when he walked into the temple courts and he overturned the money changers' tables,
that's right.
That was the crime. That was a crime there that would have angered
disturbing the peace,
the Jewish people. It would have disturbed the Romans. It would have been a huge disturbance of the peace. And that is what is going to lead to his arrest. But we are going to pick up from there next week on part two of the trial of Jesus. All right, Chris.
Jesus Christo.
It is now time for Courtroom Quarterback. Chris, I know before we leave this podcast, we do have to touch on a couple of interesting trades that happened in the NFL because I know football is not going on, but football is still king. We got to talk about football. So, Chris, what are your thoughts being a non-Chiefs fan or non-Chiefs homer about the Chiefs' moves this last week?
I mean, they gave Chris Jones what he was looking for, right? They gave him the franchise contract that he wanted a year ago. He got a contract a year ago that was mediocre, some would say good, but came and he performed and he was key in the Chiefs' victory. So they came back from the bank and said, "Here you go, here's your sack of money. Please stay with us forever."
Now I believe it's $32 million a year for 5 years, but only about $98 million of it is guaranteed. So the reality is, he has a 3-year guaranteed contract. Will this go to years 4 or to year 5? I don't know. That's Stay where tuned. I think the Chiefs won out because the Chiefs did not want a long-term contract. So this contract had a lot of guaranteed money. It also gave the Chiefs the option at the end to cut him, I guess, if his performance is not there. So I think this is a great win for Chris Jones. He gets a lot of guaranteed money. And let's
$100 million.
Yeah, he's going to be good enough back then. The Chiefs are going to keep him around. I heard it analyzed. Maybe you sent it to me, but if you are a defensive back and you are a shutdown corner, you stop one of the other team's receivers. If you are Chris Jones and you know how to put pressure on the quarterback, you stop all of the receivers.
Absolutely. I mean, Chris Jones absolutely is worth that investment. Was he kind of a punk, last season when he was holding out for his contract and it was iffy if he was going to stay? Kind of a punk, yes, but being kind of a punk is also a smart business decision sometimes.
I kind of agree, but I am going to go not punkish because the contract he ended up signing last year was a total bet on himself. It was so incentive-laden that required him to get so many sacks. He got it on the 17th week of the season. It required the Chiefs to advance in the playoffs and to win the Super Bowl for him to get all of his money. Well, he came and he performed and was critical to the Chiefs winning the Super Bowl. And so to that regard, he bet on himself. And he won. So congratulations to Chris Jones for that. So I'm thinking the Chiefs are now position to win, to three-peat, critical to the Chiefs three-peating. And Chris, I want to put you in this the hot seat here. Let's say you were the dad of one Patrick Mahomes, of a quarterback.
Okay.
And you are going to get paid $57 million a year because you are being underpaid, but you're the best quarterback in the land. Okay. Would you restructure your contract to the tune of $20 million to free up cap space so the Chiefs can sign other players? I mean, think about it. When the Chiefs are restructuring.
Absolutely.
You would do it.
Absolutely.
Give up $20 million
for now.
Right.
Here's the thing, right? The money from football is very finite. That is a small pie. But if you could be a 3, 4, 5, 6 time Super Bowl champion, Thomas J. Brady, and take less money, right? So that way you could build a championship team around you and get 6 rings, you will forever be in the conversation and you will forever be sought after, right? Tom Brady is going to have endorsement deals. He's going to have brands. You got to think about it like how Michael Jordan really revolutionized this thought, where he knew he wasn't going to make his money playing for the Bulls. He was going to make his money in endorsement deals and post Bulls life.
Right.
And that has really set the tone for a smart, savvy, business centered quarterback. Yeah, they play a game and it's a lot of fun. But when you get a savvy, smart, business centered quarterback or a center in Shaquille O'Neal or, you know, Jordan, all, you know, these guys that realize that this is a business, not a game.
Yes.
Yeah. I'll take back $20 million. You want me to restructure my deal? $20 million. I'll eventually get that $20 million from the Chiefs one way or another. It may be residuals. It may be like a Bobby Bonilla thing where you pay me $5 million a year for 20 years or however you work out.
Right.
But man, like Shohei Ohtani, right? Deferring almost $650 million of his $700 million. So that way he can turn that into $1.3 billion at the end of it. Smart business decisions free up cap space.
I agree 100%. He now realizes that the Mahomes name is a brand, and that brand is a billion-dollar a year brand. So why are you scrounging for $20 million? That's just pittance to him, right? He's in a billion-dollar arena. So he is talking about commercials. He's talking about his brand, his likeness. He's going to be there for many years after he retires. His value is so immense. Let's say he does three-peat. What will that do to the only quarterback in the history of the NFL to three-peat when it comes to Super Bowls? It's going to be amazing. Mm-hmm. He recognizes the bigger picture, and I think it was a great move on his part. And plus, I'm a Chiefs fan.
Super smart.
So I'm all about that. All right.
Well, and I mean, and I just, it's just good business. Like, take it, it could be anybody, right? Tom Brady, neither of us are Patriots fans, and neither of us are Buccaneers fans. But we could see the genius in what Tom Brady did to make sure that the dynasty that was the Patriots stayed a dynasty. One man does not make a football team.
All right, I'm going to give you 3 different options here. I want you to rate them as far as the best move for that team. You have the Buccaneers signing the 100% A-listed prick, according to the GM. That's what he called Baker Mayfield. The Buccaneers re-signed Baker. The Raiders,
$33 million,
signed the Mr. Stash. I believe, isn't that what they call him? The mustache, the stash.
Gardner missed you. Yep.
Or was now the Uncle Falcons getting the multi-MVP, multi-Super Bowl champion. Oh, no, I got that wrong. 0 MVPs, 0 Super Bowl titles. Kirk, the billionaire Cousins.
Right.
Which one is the better signing? Look,
from what standpoint?
I don't know.
Right? I think Gardner Minshew, we can just roll out of whatever. He's just a fun character to follow, right? I think he's the number 3 of this discussion, right? Of a 1-2-3 combo, Gardner's number 3. He went to the Raiders that are releasing Jimmy Garoppolo.
Chris, this
the
is
Raiders
all
are in a weird spot right
this
now.
This is all you need to know about that. As a Chiefs fan who hates the Raiders, I love that signing.
It's perfect. Now, if we want to talk about people who bet on themselves, Baker Mayfield. That guy has shown that he was wasted in Cleveland, wasted in Carolina, He performed in Tampa Bay, did well. And that was the ultimate goal of betting on yourself, along with Chris Jones, right? Right. Chris Jones bet on himself too. But Baker Mayfield put his money where his mouth is, and he gave 170%, and he's going to make $33 million a year because of it.
I think that's great. I think that's good, a great re-signing. Him. Plus, I think Baker is a good quarterback, and I think he also has learned his lesson. I think he's going to be dialed in on this contract.
Absolutely. He's getting paid for it. I think he's really – he nailed that job interview, and now he's gonna really nail the job. But Kirk Cousins, man, good gravy. Two playoff wins in his entire career. Gets a four-year, $180 million with the Falcons.
It's amazing.
I mean, the South loves their Cousins, let me tell you. Like, absolutely loves them.
All right, I could be wrong on this. I'm going to go total number of wins next year between those three signings. You got the Falcons will win more games, then the Buccaneers, yep, and then the lowly Raiders. So if you want to analyze that, I'm thinking the Cousins, the Falcons got the best deal. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I'm saying that. I'm going to go Cousins,
I mean,
Buccaneers, and Raiders.
Yep, I totally agree. I'm there with that.
Lastly here, the Eagles signed Saquon Barkley, and running backs, I am very nervous about. I don't understand why the Eagles did that. Barkley can't even stay healthy for a year. But, you know, maybe I'm thinking of another running back who couldn't stay healthy, went to San Fran, and was a game changer. So do you think Barkley is going to have the same impact on the Eagles that your boy had McCaffrey. With the San Francisco, McCaffrey had with the San Francisco 49ers?
I don't think so. I think McCaffrey's a different level of talent. But what I do see is that Jalen Hurts, I think the Eagles are going to be much bigger contenders now, adding Saquon Barkley to the backfield. Daniel Jones was just underusing. Like, Daniel Jones is useless. But they're going to pay him over Saquon. And I think Saquon's going to get some major yards and really put the Eagles on track to be contenders in the NFC.
There you go. All right. Hey, it's been a great podcast. Yep. Have a great week. And we'll come back next week and on part two of the trial of Jesus. Have a great Easter week and talk to you next Friday.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star review. We need your love to help us continue highlighting the funnier side of the law. I want to give a special shout out to our Vice President of Operations, Wendy Oster, without whom this entire operation would be a complete and utter mess. Sean Wynn and 15.5 Features for making me sound way better than I actually do. Brooke Bolin for our marketing efforts, and Ryan Kuhn and Paul Kuhn of Triplicity Marketing for our technical and computer support.